Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz here on a Canucks game day. We are live from the Kintec studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver, online at DunbarLumber.com. Canucks played four games between today and our last show, which was way back, what would it have been, like March 16th, 15th, something like that. A lot happened in that stretch, including, especially over the last three games, as you were saying earlier in the show, Drantz, the top six for this team, new look top six, really starting to look impressive. And I think that was highlighted especially against Calgary on Saturday when Nils Höglander scores twice, playing on a line with Elias Pettersson and Connor Garland. I mean, look, there's a bunch of ways we can go with this. One is that Nils Höglander has 22 even strength goals this year, which is an incredible mark, and he's playing really, really well. There's that side of it. There's the Höglander specific side of it, but there's also just, hey, Nils Höglander, Elias Pettersson, Connor Garland are playing really, really well together right now.
There's also the Pew Suter side of it.
Yep.
Which I think is the under, like, Höglander's a young player who's come up through the organization and then, you know, looked like, struggled so mightily under Bruce mm-hmm. Boudreau that I think it, you know, fooled some people, Rick Dhaliwal, into thinking he wasn't very good. But, you know, this guy basically arrived in the NHL as a ready-made top six caliber guy, in my opinion. And now being given that opportunity, it looks awesome. It looks awesome. I do think one thing about Höglander, though, is his athleticism has leveled up a lot. And like, in particular, his core strength, you know, the amount of control he has along the wall, we've described him as sticky.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? When oncoming forecheckers or when he beats a defender to the puck, and whether or not they win the battle, whether or not he loses the battle or comes out with the puck, and he often comes out with the puck, he holds it there long enough that reinforcement arrives. You know, like that. It's almost Higgins-like. It's Chris Higgins-like. He's so athletic and physically strong that he has just this amount of control along the wall. I think it really enables this team's transition game. One play I didn't think got enough love from the Calgary game was the Garland outlet. That was ludicrous. I mean, that guy's so good. And finally getting a look in the top six, and the returns are great. But for me, it's Pew Suter, who's the unheralded player here.
Yeah. So somebody actually texted in, is Nils Höglander a finalist for the Canucks Unsung Hero Award this season? That was from Minor Matt in Abbotsford. It has to be Pew Suter, though.
In terms of actually never being sung, it's Pew Suter.
And the effectiveness and how good they are, like, it has to be Pew Suter.
Dude, people still want to replace him. Like, when Dakota Joshua gets back, people still want to see, like, Joshua.
I'd give it a look.
There's no reason to give it a look. Pew Suter is one of your team's six best forwards, period. Period. And that line, like, okay, that line with Suter on Miller and Besser's left wing, we've seen a lot of players play with those guys. We've seen Höglander play with those guys. We've seen Phil DiGiuseppe play with those guys. We've seen
Mikheyev
play with those guys. We've seen Kuzmenko play with those guys. I mean, we've seen the lock set. We've seen Pettersson play with those guys.
Yeah, that's a good point.
The lock set Miller-Besser duo has been complemented by a variety of different players, and no one has come close to doing it as well as Pew Suter, and that includes Elias Pettersson. Okay? Among NHL lines that have played at least 100 minutes together, there's only two that have a higher expected goals clip than Suter, Miller, Besser. One of those lines has McDavid on it, and you can guess the combination. The other is like a weird Boston line, like Morgan Geeky and JVR. Whatever.
Of course.
Just the Boston
They're doing
Bruins,
it somehow.
Just the Boston Bruins breaking everyone's brain for no reason, right? Here's way more important than the XG, though. 14 goals for, 3 goals against. Plus 11!
Yeah.
It's like 170 minutes. Jamie, we do not need to see anything else. They have it. They've found it. It's Pew Suter. It's Pew Suter on the top line. Like, straight up, do not mess with it. By the way, since they put together this Höglander-Garland-Pettersson line, 5-1. So that means this new-look Canucks top six is currently 19-4 on the scoreboard.
It's pretty good.
At evens. Why change anything? Don't change anything. Let this sample expand, because we're only talking about 200 total minutes for that. Like, it could look very different.
Yeah.
Are they going to be plus 15 the next 200 minutes? Almost certainly not. But the underlying numbers match it, right? Like, this is ridiculous stuff that we're seeing in terms of control from Vancouver. The Canucks have not controlled play at an elite clip with their top six all year long until, like, the last week. Now, it's only 200 minutes. I'm not taking it to the bank or anything, but roll with this. Let's see what this looks like, because this is the sort of change that could give this team some nitrous. And what I think is interesting about it is, you know, we talked about it again. We talked about it in the whiteboard segment. For up until this last week, the Canucks were rolling along at a 91-point pace after the All-Star break, mm-hmm. hitting something of a skid for the first time all season. And I think that's possibly, it's possible that that ended up being a good thing, in that it caused Tocchet to hit the whiteboard. We've, again, discussed
to try
this,
some things.
We've discussed this all year. Things were going almost too well for the Canucks that they didn't have to solve problems in terms of changing up their lineup. Like, oh yeah, we can play Phil DiGiuseppe with the top six. Like, fine. It's
we're
fine.
Winning.
Kuzmenko, Mikheyev, Pettersson didn't work for a single shift all year. And then they ran with it for like 400 minutes. They got outscored. Like, come on. And so I think things went so well that they didn't have to kind of look at things. And all of a sudden, you've got this team's six best forwards in the top six, and the returns are incredible. Incredible.
The Suter part of it is, I mean, look, at the beginning of the year, if you told me, hey, Pugh Suter is going to be your number first line left winger, and it's going to work really, really well, I would have been a little concerned.
Sorry.
No you might have.
No. No one is higher on Pugh Suter than me,
but,
I think. And
yeah.
I would never have said that.
No, but I will say I'm not totally surprised, because we've seen him just do so much this year. He's played literally everywhere in all situations, and it's worked, and he's been good no matter where he's been or what role he's been asked to play. Hoglander, big glow up from where he was earlier in the season, but again, we've seen him have success in the top six. We've seen him, you know, score goals in this league before. I think the biggest development here is Connor Garland finding a spot in the top six, and I'm really curious to see how long that lasts, because how many times have we talked about it, right? That we all saw what Connor Garland was doing for the third line this year, and the way he was driving play, the way he was producing, the way he was carrying that line. And the natural inclination when you see a guy on the third line doing that is, well, all right, let's increase his role. Let's get him up to the top six. Hey, we've got a player in Elias Pettersson. Maybe we want to get going. Let's get this dynamo from the third line up to the top six. The problem has always been, it's never looked, whenever they've tried to play Connor Garland with one of their two best centers in Miller or Pettersson, it's never looked particularly good. If that flips all of a sudden, and it's not like Connor Garland deserves to be in the top six, but it doesn't feel right when he's there. If all of a sudden it feels right and you're able to keep him there alongside Elias Pettersson and Nils Höglander, that's a huge development for this team. Like, finding that home in the top six for Connor Garland, that's the biggest deal. Out of all three of those kind of relatively unheralded in different way players helping out the top six right now, that Garland one feels like the biggest deal.
Well, I don't know that it's fair to say that it never looked good with him and Pettersson. They just didn't try it.
Mm.
Like, over the last 2 years, it's been very rare that Garland has taken shifts like with Pettersson overall. I mean, they've played 40 minutes or so of late, but prior to that, very rare that Pettersson and Garland were played together. He played some with Bo Horvat, especially early on in his Canucks tenure. They've tried him out with Miller occasionally, but very occasionally. But, you know, you sort of look down, think about how rarely we've seen the Lotto line. and Pettersson's played 40 minutes more with Miller than he has with Garland. And that's with the two spending like 40 minutes together just over the last week. You know, before that, Garland had played like less with Pettersson than Sam Lafferty, less with Pettersson than Pugh Suter, less with Pettersson than even like Dakota Joshua. And I can't even think of the shifts that they've had together. Doesn't even occur to me. So I just think it was something that they didn't do. For whatever reason, it was something that they didn't.
And it wasn't just Pettersson, though, right? It was just an overall reluctance, even going back to when Horvat was here, to consistently have Connor Garland with those players.
Well, he played top six under Boudreau.
For stretches.
And he played top six under... It was really once Tocchet came in that he started Joshua, Amon, Garland down the stretch of last season. And then after that, it was like Garland is going to help us drive our third line, the buzzsaw word that Tocchet likes to throw around. And Tocchet, Joshua became like a fixed duo for Tocchet. And I think that just was so successful that they didn't.
Yep.
It was so successful and the team was so successful that they didn't need to consider alternatives. This is how I think, you know, we like to do the, but most analysts like to do the like, adversity is good for a hockey team thing. And I often think adversity is good for a hockey team only if it helps you find something better.
Yeah, if it forces you to ask some questions and try some things out.
Especially because coaches are way too slow to make these changes in season because, you know, you're managing relationships. It's complicated. It's not as easy as just like juking your lineup. There's all sorts of, you know, relationships, team pecking order considerations, financial, contractual, cap considerations go into what a lineup looks like, on and on. And what's always interesting to me is you get to the playoffs and coaches become far more proactive, far more quick to change their lineup. And that's, you know, necessity is the mother of innovation, right? This team struggled, and I think Tocchet found a really interesting answer in the top six. You don't need to know too much more than 19 goals for and 4 goals against with those two lines on the ice so far.
That'll play for sure. Todd has bad takes. Says, do you guys think the Canucks have any concerns about a PD Garland Hoglander line in the playoffs? Which is a fair question, I think, given how we know this coach prioritizes size, how the management group does, right?
I'd add this. Suter, like, throw Suter into that mix. Like, you're talking about a top six that both isn't that big and kind of isn't that fast.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, but they're all good players.
But I will say for Hoglander, PD Garland, that line, just looking at it as a trio, one, I don't mind it so much because to me it clarifies the roles that every line is going to be expected to play, right? Like, you just know that that's not going to be there. You're going to try to find that line in particular softer minutes, right? Like, they're not going to use a line with Hoglander and Garland on it in a matchup or even a secondary matchup role. So you have the Miller line, which has consistently been out there against really tough opponents all year. And then in this kind of formation, pending Elias Lindholm's health, you'd have a line probably with Elias Lindholm and Ilya Mikheyev and maybe Dakota Joshua.
Yeah, and
it, right?
Maybe it's Bluger if
maybe
Lindholm's
it's Bluger, and
that's banged up.
You can do your kind of secondary, probably tough matchup, something like that, right? And then you have, look, if you have Pettersson, Garland, and Hoglander, and you just say, you know what, we're going to use them in an extreme offensive role, I don't think that's the worst thing in the world. I don't think it's ideal from the Canucks' perspective, right? Like, I think they would love to have bigger players getting these same results in those spots, but if they're getting results, like, well, all right. Sometimes you can't always have the perfect fit at hand that you feel great about going into the playoffs necessarily.
It's straight up just your six best forwards. Like, I don't know what else to... There's no other way to caption it. It's your six best forwards. That's it. Like, that's what the top six, as currently constituted, is for the Canucks. We've talked about it all season. Will they have to steal from the bottom six to stabilize the top six? Having done so, it looks great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this to me is the look. This is the look, and you know, we'll see how much extra push it gives the team in terms of a gear, like an extra gear potentially. We've kind of been teased by that already this season with like the Lotto line, you know, so I'm not taking anything to the bank, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But
and I will say the top six looks great, but as you said, kind of taking from the bottom six to bolster the top six, and I think pending Lindholm's health and form, there's still a question about the depth in the bottom six then, right? Like, that's it. Now, you'd rather have your top six clicking and then have those questions in the bottom six rather than vice versa, right? You want your most important players going well. But I think it's fair then to look at the depth chart and not be nervous necessarily, but you can see ways where, like I just said, Lindholm, Mikheyev, Joshua on a line. I don't mind that, but it's missing some dynamic offensive presence.
Make
probably.
It Bluger.
Sure.
I think then you're looking at having an average third line relative to the rest of the Western Conference. You know, it playoff picture from a playoff picture standpoint. You certainly don't have the sort of push that Dallas is going to get from Stankoven Johnston.
Mm.
You certainly don't have the kind of reliability that the Avs will have with, you know, your Ross Colton types. But, you know, do you like it better than whatever the Edmonton Oilers are tossing out there? I think so.
Mm-hmm.
So, I kind of think it comes out in the wash. At the end of the day, third lines can win you a championship, but first lines and second lines are...
That's the thing.
That's the highest leverage.
If you want to choose where to have it going, you choose the top six. It's pretty
easy.
You got it. And you'll figure it out in the bottom six.
Yeah. And, you know, it helps that, like, Neil Zaman's played well. Vasily Podkolzin looks like a guy, I don't think you'd take from the lineup. I mean, one of the reasons why going with a somewhat shorter, smaller top six, I think shouldn't be a concern, is, you know, when you get Joshua back and you have Podkolzin in the lineup and you have Lafferty, like, you know, are you too small up front in terms of your top six? Maybe. But I think your overall team size
right.
is actually going to be pretty robust, especially if...
Well, you get to the blue line, right, where size is not an issue at all.
Yeah.
Right?
Right. If you're looking at, like, a Lafferty Amon Podkolzin fourth line, you've got Joshua Mikheyev on your third line... you've got Miller up front, you know, you've got Pettersson up front who's slight, but is like a big guy still and has gotten a lot bigger. And then you've got the tree trunks, the ants on your blue line. I don't think that's a team where it's so overmatched physically or going to be so overmatched physically that you can afford to be like, well, we thus have to play a less efficient.
Yeah, we have to move Joshua up because we're terrified of the size deficit in our top six.
And look, I'm open to seeing it. I just don't. Suter's been so key on that line. I really think we're not paying enough attention to how much he's given that line just a real, you know, kick, a real kickstart in
Suter's
terms of
awesome.
Their ability to control play.
He's been so good. It's been incredible. It's been so much fun to watch this year. And I think the big
takeaway, the reason I thought he should be a $4 million player, Jamie.
The big takeaway is you're not going back to the old third line, right? Not as, like, because for a while there it was, hey, as soon as Joshua's back, it's Bluger, Garland, Joshua back together. I think as long as Garland is doing what he's doing alongside Elias Pettersson and that line's having success, you put that on hold and you find other solutions the bottom six.
It might be a solution at some point. Like it might
It's something you can have in your back pocket, but it's not the instant Joshua is healthy. No. You have to go back to it.
This top six, this is like Mandalorian level. This is the way.
Yes. I wanted to read this text because it starts out very funny. But he says, I missed you both deeply. Could not sleep last night in anticipation of your return. Dreamt about your guys' laughs filling the shells of my ears.
No.
Anyways, what are your takes on Atu Ratu's production of late in Abbotsford and how the front office views him now? So I mostly just wanted to read that because I thought it was very funny. But... Yeah, Atu Ratu, 9 points in 3 games down in Abbotsford. Shout out to Atu Ratu. And look, I don't think that's going to change how he figures in the remainder of this season necessarily. I mean, you never know, right? Finishing strong at Abbotsford is great. But it makes things more interesting coming into training camp for Atu Ratu last year if he finishes on a real, real hot streak at the end of the regular season and into the playoffs for Abbotsford.
Well, it also throws him, I mean, yeah. I think it needs to be sustained. If this is a three-game blip, it's a three-game blip.
Yes.
But, you know, with his blow-up over the course of the past week, you know, he's now at 0.75 points per game in the American League as a 21-year-old center. That's good. That becomes a pretty interesting statistical profile.
Mm-hmm.
Probably enhances his overall asset value, by the way. And if it's a harbinger of what's to come for Ratu and, you know, down the stretch and into the playoffs, there could be more juice here than perhaps we'd thought at various points this season.
And it's just, to me, again, it's more of a next season thing because we know how many questions this team is going to have to answer in terms of replacing players and managing the cap next year.
Things will have gone badly if we see Ratu.
Yes, yes. That means
year.
A lot of injuries have piled up.
Yeah,
if that's
the
case.
That would be a tough spot to be in.
Yeah, so I don't think it's plays a role in this year in the playoff push or anything, but certainly great for him, great for the player, and makes things really interesting coming into training camp next year. We will take a break. As mentioned, our old pal, Gemma Karsten-Smith, she's back on the Vancouver Canucks beat for the Canadian Press, and she will join the show next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
Big opinions and good bets. It's the People's Show with Bick Nizar. Be sure to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We're live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? The hotline is brought to you by Dispatch Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning. The first call, the only call, we now go to the Dispatch Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning hotline, where we are joined from the Canadian Press, back on the show after a lengthy hiatus, and back on the Canucks beat as well. She is Gemma Karsten-Smith. Gemma, it is a pleasure to have you back on the show. How are you?
Hi, friends. I missed you.
We missed you very much. And I got to be honest, I mean, so you were of course off on maternity leave. I don't think it's a secret to say that. But you come back. You know, you cover the team last year, a very interesting year, let's put it mildly. You come back, and this team is now on the verge of becoming the first team to clinch a playoff spot in the NHL. Like, has there been a sense of whiplash for you just in how different things are now that you're covering this team again on a day-to-day basis?
Just how I drew it up, obviously. No. I had no thoughts whatsoever that this team would be anywhere near where they're at, not only in the standings, but what we're seeing on the ice as well. It's been absolutely fascinating to watch from afar over the months that I was away. And now that I'm back, it's really neat to be back in the rink and covering it and be part of what seems to be an upswell in excitement, not only around the team, but throughout the city as well. It's I honestly thought that this was going to be a bubble team. And by bubble, I mean like on the playoff bubble, not like in the bubble we shall not speak of. But I'm so happy to be proven wrong, because I think this is a fan base that deserves some excitement, and it's definitely what we've got over the last few months and what we're expecting to get plenty more of moving forward here.
What stood out the most to you in terms of just the difference being around the team on a day-to-day basis and kind of the mood, the vibe, everything, as you said, being at the rink, talking to the team, what's kind of stood out to you as most obviously different about that experience now compared to last year?
Rick Tocchet is the short answer. Let me elaborate. I think that he has brought a completely different energy to this team. We started to see it at the end of last year, but I think there was a lengthy feeling out process after everything that group had been through. I think that they have since bought in really and truly to this system, to that word that we heard again and again and again, the structure. But we're seeing it on the ice, and we see it in the media room as well. When we talk to Rick Tocchet, the way that he speaks to us is completely different than we've seen from any other coach, not just with the Canucks, but with other visiting teams that come through too. The way that Rick Tocchet will sit and break down a specific play, a specific formation, and really get into the nitty-gritty, I think you see how much he loves hockey and how much of a hockey mind he is. And I think that has permeated through the team, both on and off the ice. It has changed the vibe entirely, but it's also changed how this team plays entirely. And I think that it really starts with the coach.
Gemma, one thing that's been interesting is occasionally Tocchet will express real exasperation with the performance of his team. You know, he did it after the Washington Capitals loss just last weekend. And what's sort of been a fascinating dynamic this year is every time it's happened, this team's responded. We've seen that this week. What do you take from how connected, in some ways, it seems, this team is to Tocchet's challenges in particular?
I think that this team respects Rick Tocchet more than we can possibly understand. I think the fact that he played the way he played and the success that he's had, not only as a player, but as a coach, as an assistant coach and whatnot, I think they respect him for who he is and the hockey mind he is, and they believe in him. And I think that when he expresses exasperation, as you mentioned, there's kind of we disappointed dad kind of feeling, and not in the like we're petulant teens and like we don't care if we disappoint dad, but like, oh my gosh, dad is my favorite person in the world, I can't believe I let him down that kind of like we disappointed dad. So I think that that's a big part of it. I think that he's done a lot of hard work to build relationships with each and every one of his players. And when we see how they respond, that's the impact, right? That's what we're seeing. We're seeing them say, oh, I can't let this guy down. I can't let my teammates down. I can't let myself down, but I can't let talk down. And I think that it's really changed a lot throughout this organization.
And, you know, as you mentioned, Gemma, we've noticed it right from when he became the head coach of the team. And certainly this year, Rick Tocchet's so willing to go into detail, right? And so excited often, as you said, he just loves hockey, loves talking hockey. And there's none of that, or so much less, I guess, of that guardedness that so often you hear from head coaches around the league and even players around the league. And as you mentioned, you know, I think that's gone a long way to build those relationships with the players. But I think another big part of the story of this season is kind of the fan base getting back on board with this team and getting really, really excited about this team again. Obviously, that's driven by the results on the ice in large part. But I think from the early going, too, a lot of it was the job of Rick Tocchet. You know, in this market specifically, it feels like his style works so well and connects so well with the fans of this team.
For sure. I spent a lot of my parental leave listening to you fine folks talk about the Canucks, because there's only so much like talk I can do with a four-year-old in a small baby. Like I just need to hear adult voices many times during the day. My children are lovely. They're fabulous, but adults are nice too. Anyway, to listen to how fans have responded over the course of the season has been fascinating. Like, I would love to be doing some sort of sociological dig into the psyche of these folks, because they have been hurt many times and often, and just to watch them slowly, like, oh, they're winning. Oh, do we trust them? Is this for real? Oh, this is for real. Oh, can we talk about playoffs? Like, it's just the journey that fans have been on through this season has been fascinating. And I think that Tocchet has, again, he's helped this fan base kind of regain some trust. Like, he's helping, he's doing some real therapy out there in the Canucks world. And it's obviously necessary, and he's doing good work. I think that he's helped really create belief both around the team and in the city in what this organization is trying to do, whether that's, just whether they just make the playoffs this year or whether they go on a big deep run, people believe in Rick Tocchet and his plan. So I think there's a lot of excitement around him going forward here.
Do you think Tocchet's wrapped up the Jack Adams here, Gemma?
I mean, it's his to lose, right? Right?
Yeah.
I can't see how anyone else truly challenges for it. I mean, Burnett, with his what's the word I'm looking for? His unique style, the concert cancellation is fascinating. But I think it's hard to argue with how Tocchet has taken this team from where they were to where they are now. I can't imagine that it's not his.
Same question, but for Quinn Hughes. Is Quinn Hughes wrapped up the Norris?
I think so, but I mean, Drance, you know how many of these people vote from out east, and like, yes, they're finally watching Quinn Hughes, but I think that that bias continues, that Eastern bias. I don't know how you can argue with how Quinn Hughes has played this season. Like, I can't see how he doesn't deserve it. It's not just the points. Obviously, he's this incredible, he's on this tear where he's breaking his own records yet again, and he's putting up points that the likes of which we haven't really seen in this market ever, but also that we haven't seen much across the NHL for a long time. Carlson is the outlier, and, like, don't get me started, that was a flawed team to start with. Anyway, I think that it's more about Hughes as a defenseman as well. The progress that you have seen in his 200-foot game, not just over the last season, but since his he entered this league is incredible. And I think that that has to pay off at this point. I don't see how it couldn't, just because he is such a well-rounded player. He's grown into a leader, not just for the Canucks, obviously being the captain, but in this league. And I think that to not honor him with the Norris this year would be foolish.
Yeah, I can't see what would have to happen down the stretch here for Quinn Hughes to lose the award. I mean, Eastern bias notwithstanding, because I think you're right about that, Gemma, but he's just been so dominant. And then you throw in the fact that, you know, he's the captain for this team as well. There are just so many reasons to give him the award, and I think he will end up taking it at home at the end of the day. Certainly, I know he's the odds-on favorite right now. We were talking earlier in the show about, you know, it's an admittedly small sample here, but over this three-game winning streak, the Canucks' top six has really gotten going. And you've seen Connor Garland and Nils Höglander find homes next to Elias Pettersson. That looks like it's helped Pettersson's game. Pew Suter is with JT Miller and Brock Besterson, and that is still in that line, is really, really working. Have you seen enough that at least, you know, hey, maybe Dakota Joshua comes back, you still have Elias Lindholm, but have you seen enough from this top six configuration that, you know, it should be the look going forward and even into the playoffs for the Canucks?
I think that what we're going to see a lot more of over the next stretch of games and as they prepare for the playoffs here is trying to figure out what really and truly works. I don't think that we've seen the end of combinations, because you want to get the best as you're heading into playoffs, right? Obviously, duh. I know we haven't been there for a long time, but like that's just kind of math, right? So I don't know that this is anything is etched in stone here. I love the look of the Pettersson, Garland, Höglander line, a couple of short kings. Like, come on. They're just working so well together. I think that the fire that those three have had the last few games has been incredible. And, like, Höglander is just popping. It's so great to see, because we've long thought that he had this in him, and to see this combination bring it out is awesome. I think that the Miller and Besser combo has been so strong all season, and it doesn't really matter who you put with them. I think to have the option of sliding Pettersson up to play with them is such a great weapon to have. But I don't think that we've seen the last of the combinations as we head down the final stretch here, just because coaches are going to want to see everything available and really try and test all of the chemistry before the big show actually begins.
Do you get to the point where, in planning out and thinking about the next month, right? Because we're less than a month out from the start of the Stanley Cup playoffs now, Gemma. Do you start to think about which opponent this team should want to see, fans of this team should want to see in the first round? Do you have a take on that?
Oh, absolutely. I think who you don't want to see is Edmonton, honestly. I think, yeah, they're bobbling right now, but Connor McDavid in the playoffs is Connor McDavid in the playoffs.
Yep.
Like, come on. You don't want to face that. I think the Canucks are in such an awesome place right now that if they could hang on to that number one spot and face Vegas, yeah, Vegas is scary. Vegas are the reigning cup champs. Obviously, they're going to be scary. But Vegas also has been pretty middling after they went on that absolute tear to start the season. Yes, they've dealt with a lot of injuries. We don't know what's going to happen, who they're going to bring back in time for playoffs. But I don't know that you can field the Vegas team that we saw last June. I just don't think that's the Golden Knights that are going to show up. If I'm looking at the possible opponents right now, I'm feeling pretty good about either about the Golden Knights. I don't want to take on this Nashville team that they've got points in what, 17 straight now? Like, that momentum is real. That momentum going into the playoffs is scary. Yeah, they're probably going to lose a few down the stretch here. They've got 11 games left to play or whatever. But to be coming into the playoffs on that kind of a run is terrifying. I would much rather see a Vegas team that's been battered and bruised throughout the season, and that they might be the Stanley Cup champs, but they're not what they once were.
It's kind of remarkable because, you know, it wasn't that long ago where I think fans were looking at it and saying, okay, whoever that eighth playoff team in the West, the top seven look really daunting, but that eighth team should be a pretty enticing opponent for the first round. And then Nashville has just gone and completely blown that up. And now, you know, it looks like they might be the seventh seed. It's actually pretty remarkable. You know, if Vegas gets hot down the stretch, we could be in a world where all eight playoff teams in the Western Conference have 100 points or 99 or something like that. Like, the playoff bar could be very, very high in the Western Conference this year. It doesn't feel like there's any kind of – it's all pick your poison basically at this point with what Nashville is doing right now is what I'm saying.
Absolutely. And like I said, totally how I drew it up.
Just how we all saw it coming here.
It's crazy. There's so many things that happened this season that I like just could not see coming. I didn't see Edmonton totally falling apart. I didn't see I thought that the Kings would be a little bit better than they are. I thought that the Flames would make a push for it. Like, there's so many parts of this season that I'm just like, huh, shrug. Didn't see that coming. But the biggest one has got to be the Canucks being where they are. I think it says a lot about the work that this front office has done to remake this team, especially on the defensive end, and about how Rick Tocchet has really put some magic in a bottle and is shaking it all up to, I don't know, explode in some
make a stew. He's made a
sure,
stew.
Okay, that works better.
He's got a stew going.
A delicious, Gemma. Yummy stew. Gemma, thanks for doing this. A thrill to have you back on the show. We'll do it again soon.
Thanks, guys. Talk to you soon.
That is Gemma Karsten-Smith from the Canadian Press. And I'm always excited to chat with Gemma, but in particular because I think she just has such a fascinating perspective, right? Having been away from the team for almost a year and then coming back and stepping into this version of the team. Now, she covered Rick Tocchet when he came in last year, right? Because she was there till the end of the season. So she saw, you know, the beginnings of the Rick Tocchet era. But then all of a sudden, you kind of step back into this team that's challenging for the President's Trophy, challenging for, you know, it looks like they're going to win their division and all of that. And it's just, I don't think anyone actually forgets, but it's useful to just kind of step back and take that trip back in time, you know, 12 plus months down the road, and remember what an incredible turnaround this is. Like, how different it is. Just how different on a day-to-day vibes level this team is than they were at this time last year.
And I think they've evolved a ton over the course of the season. I really do think the team we're watching right now is totally different in terms of their level, in terms of their defensive play, in terms of their two-way profile than what we saw in November, you know, which is a credit to a lot of people, right? There's a lot of people that have enabled this, you know, from Vancouver's best players leveling up almost across the board to, you know, like even the midseason ads, Zadorov, right? The Lindholm thing would be sort of the one sort of move that hasn't moved the needle.
Yes. And again, I still think there's time. Now he's got to be healthy.
Yeah, I mean, we now that we understand that maybe he's been hurt, I think it begins to make a lot more sense. Because even people are saying stuff like, oh, at least he's playing well defensively. It's like, not really. You know?
Yeah, I don't think he was bad defensively, but it wasn't as if it was like, you know,
you
wouldn't isolate him as the reason they'd leveled up defensively.
You couldn't have told me based on his play in a Canucks jersey at any point that like you'd rather have him on the third line than Suter.
Sure, but that's Pugh Suter we're talking about.
Well, maybe than Blueger. You know, like that's kind of like, I don't even know that he was an upgrade on the team's third line center options, except that his presence allows you to play Suter up higher. But, you know, that's the only move that hasn't worked out yet. And as we know, it's not going to be judged based on what's happening.
No, it's going to, at this point, it's completely dependent on what happens in the playoffs.
He's one clutch goal away.
Exactly. Clutch goal and like, you know, a few games of tough matchup minutes where it goes well. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, I don't care. I don't care what they gave up
100%
to get him if he helps them win that big playoff series.
We also have gone the whole show. I mean, we've been gone the whole week, but the Demko thing, you know, is still interesting to me. I mean, DeSmith's played great, which is great for him. You know, with goaltenders whose form tends to vacillate pretty unpredictably, right? You know, my sort of general rule is you can have not just a good week, you can have a good four months, Joey Decord style, but at some point reality tends to check in. You know, at some point, like, this team's going to need Demko to be healthy if they're going to get to where I think everyone hopes they can. Come spring.
I think the Demko and DeSmith thing has played out, honestly, pretty much like exactly how we would have expected. Where it's like, of course this team, the defensive acumen is good enough, is high enough, that,
that
the bottom is not going to fall out all of a sudden just because Thatcher Demko is on the shelf, right? And that's what we've seen.
But he's been better than
that. You still want him.
He's been better than
that. Yeah, of course. But we also, I think we knew that Casey DeSmith, as you said, goalies are volatile.
Yep.
It's not breaking news necessarily for a goalie to have like a good five stretch.
No.
Five game stretch, right?
No, he's played really well though. It's good to see.
It is.
You know, I'm curious to see, and there's no way to know this, right? It's just one of those things, like with the Lindholm thing, right? The Lindholm thing just introduces some uncertainty. The Canucks will probably have some other injury scares. I mean, we saw JT Miller leave the game after a shot block a few weeks ago. Tocchet admitting he was like, oh my God, on the bench, right? We're going to have more of these over the remaining 11 games in this Canucks season. But, you know, the Demko one looms large for obvious reasons. He's no worse than this team's third most important player. And,
yep.
and I think I'll hear the argument for far higher than that. You know, is this the sort of rest that's good for him? Right. Or is this, you know, the equivalent of like a quarterback who has an injury with their throwing shoulder? Right. And it's like they'll be cleared to return to the playoffs. And then you see them and he can't throw over the middle.
Mm.
You know, like I we just don't know.
And we won't know until we see it. We won't know until we see him in a game.
Well, and
we might hear things. We might hear a little bit more and reports out there, but we won't know until we see it.
There's also the probability that he comes back and maybe has like one shaky outing. And people are like, he looks slower moving across the crease, just like making up things to justify what's fundamentally a random outcome. So we might even see it and not know it.
Yeah. Well, you'll have to get a sample size of some sort, right? Before you can. I mean, even then it's goaltending.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like unless you're Kevin Woodley.
And even then.
And it's going to be hard to be like, oh, that's because of an injury, right?
Sure.
It's going to be really, really difficult. But again, it's not. I don't think it should be a big surprise to anyone that they have hung right there in terms of the Western Conference race and all of that with absent Thatcher Demko. You know what I mean?
No, but it's impressive.
It's good.
Yeah.
For sure. And I mean, I don't think they were going to rush him back in any universe necessarily, but if Casey DeSmith is holding down the fort for you in the regular season, you got a chance to clinch here. I think it gives you a lot more breathing room in terms of when you bring him back.
Well, and how you ramp him up.
Yeah, exactly.
No question.
I think the other question there, as you pointed out about injury scares and all that, and you know, we've seen a little bit of load management on the blue line with Ian Cole sitting out for a couple of games. Now, based on what they lined up at practice yesterday, it looks like Cole would be getting back in. Noah Juulsen might be coming out of the lineup, although we'll see when the puck drops tonight, or at least when they take the ice for warmups, but not necessarily in terms of guys like star players sitting out, because there is always that sense, too, that you want to make sure everyone's firing at all cylinders. You want to make sure everyone's at the top of their game. But just in terms of, like, minutes, I wonder how much we do see, especially once they've clinched, if it looks like there's, you know, Edmonton's done in the Pacific Division chase, all of that. I do wonder how much we see just a little bit of kind of minutes management from Rick Tocchet. It's a difficult needle to thread, though, right? As you were saying, it was after that Washington game where he's saying, hey, we got to be ramping up here. This is the time of year to ramp up and to be really hitting our stride. But you also don't want JT Miller going out in a game after you've clinched a playoff spot and are going to win the division, right? You don't want an injury to happen in that scenario either.
Yeah, rest versus rust. And you know, you do have to be mindful, too, of the psychological edges that you're giving teams. I mean, you're still going to play in Vegas. You've still got two more games against the Kings, including tonight. You've still got that game 80 against the Edmonton Oilers.
Game 82 against Winnipeg.
There's still games where you don't want to, like, seed.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to seed any mental edge come playoff time. In fact, you might want to sharpen your own. So, you know, it's a tough balance. And I guarantee you this, we'll backseat drive it.
They really have. They have four games against non-playoff teams, right? They play the Ducks on Sunday. They've got two against Arizona in April and then one against the Flames. The other seven are against really good teams.
If you clinch tonight, if you get up to like 95% chance of winning the Pacific Division, you know, those Arizona games, it's like, nails them on 12 minutes, 12 and a half minutes over under. Yeah. Let's go. Come on.
You want some power play
over
time, Niels? Let's go.
No, I see that.
Then you want your guys out there.
That's where you need to stay sharp. Yeah. Plus, you know, you do want to make sure that Quinn hits the points totals he'll need to make his Norris candidacy unassailable. You'll want to do the same with, you know, Miller's got a chance at 100 here. He's never done it in his career. that would matter.
Ducks game is going to be big for that.
Points night?
Yeah, got to make that Ducks game count in that respect.
Yeah, except the Ducks are going to trap the whole time. We already saw it.
Ugh. Awful. Awful. All right, we'll take a break. Final segment coming up.
They're like the Waluigi version of the Mighty Ducks. Instead of quack, quack, it's trap, 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 trap.
It is funny how both them, like, what's going on down in Southern California that hockey teams are like, we just got a trap. That's what we got to do right now.
Well, Kings are more aggressive than that sometimes. But
sometimes.
The Ducks are.
Haven't been against the Canucks.
No.
We'll take a break. Final segment coming up. Get your thoughts in. 650-650 to the Dunbar Lumber text line. It is Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here live from the Kintech studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver online at dunbarlumber.com. 650, 650, as I mentioned, the Dunbar Lumber text line, and some thoughts coming in to the Dunbar Lumber text line. By the way, it is Canucks game day, of course. They're playing the LA Kings. Earlier start time, 6 o'clock. Now, interesting for a lot of reasons, not least of which is that if the result goes the Canucks' way in the, well, depending on your perspective, I guess, but if St. Louis loses against Vegas and the Canucks beat LA, then the Canucks will clinch a playoff spot tonight, March 25th, which is really incredible. But it's also interesting just because these are two good teams. We've seen some not necessarily the most entertaining games between these two teams over the last month, but certainly really interesting games, I think, between these two teams. Not likely to be a first-round playoff matchup at this point, but could easily be a second-round playoff matchup. So still fascinating. And then, of course, you know, we were talking earlier in the show, we've been talking all show about the Canucks' impressive little three-game winning streak here. And people have pointed out, okay, hey, it's three non-playoff teams. It's Buffalo, it's Montreal, and it's Calgary. Now, first of all, they're not three bottom feeders. Yeah, three non-playoff teams, but it's not like it's like Chicago, San Jose, Anaheim, or Arizona that they did it against. But I think the other thing to remember here is that good teams do lose games to those types of teams at this time of year, right? Especially if the stakes aren't particularly high for your team, which, you know, as much as they want to clinch and as much as they want to win the division and potentially win the conference, the stakes just ultimately aren't that high in these games typically for the Canucks right now. And I think just, you know, kind of put the shoe on the other foot to where the Canucks and us covering and following the team have been in past seasons, where the Canucks have played, you know, and gotten some results down the stretch. And hey, they beat a really good team, and it was that team's backup goalie in net. But, you know, they're like, hey, we outworked this team. It's relatively easy for a bad team to outwork a good team in March, because the good team's looking ahead to the playoffs. The good team's not getting up for that game in the same way that the bad team is. And I think the reason for me that I don't just write off a three-game winning streak because it was against non-playoff teams, I mean, first of all, like, you can only play who's on the schedule in front of you. And it's not exactly this unique situation for the Canucks to do better against non-playoff teams than they do against playoff teams sometimes. Everyone does that. Of course, that's why the non-playoff teams are non-playoff teams. They're easier to beat. Teams beat them more often than they do against the really good teams. But for me, it's that specifically it came after Rick Tocchet challenged their work rate, challenged their where their preparedness was going into the playoffs, right? As you mentioned, after that Washington loss. And it wasn't as if they just coasted by against these teams, right? They were challenged by the coach. And as we've seen so often, they came out and they responded. They did what the coach wanted. They upped their intensity level. That's the big takeaway. Three-game winning streak is great, and it's put them in the driver's seat very, very much in terms of the division. It's kept them with a chance to win the conference. All of those things are important. But to me, it comes down to just they were challenged on one specific thing, and they responded. And that's a continuation of so much of what we've seen from Rick Tocchet and this team, and that's why it doesn't really concern me that, yeah, it was against non-playoff teams. Well, so what? You beat non-playoff teams. They were on their schedule. You can only beat who's on your schedule, ultimately.
The results are one thing. What I like about this stretch is that they've roundly outworked these teams. That, to me, is what I've liked so much about the performances we've seen from the Canucks over the course of the past week. Not to mention, you know, my biggest concern about this team for an awfully long time has been their offense 5-on-5, right? I thought it was hyperinflated early in the year, and we saw it slow down significantly post All-Star break, mostly because of regression. They were still playing well. It's just that the goals, the margins were tighter. Now, the margins are going to keep getting tighter. I mean, one thing that remains of note in my mind is, you know, I think this Canucks team's built in some ways similarly to this Kings team, where if they score first, my goodness, it's in trouble.
They are a different team with the lead, an entirely different team with the lead.
I'd have to double check this, but with the Hoglander goal 48 seconds in against the Flames, I'm pretty sure that's the 21st time this season, 21 out of 71 games. Not just that they've scored first, but that they've scored first in the first 5 minutes. Now, that's the sort of thing that, you know, I think this team is obviously well prepared, right? Another credit to Tocchet, right? They're well prepared. They're able to jump teams early. But that's also, to some extent, random distribution.
Sure.
Right? Like, you can't count on that. You can't count on that. And the other thing you can't count on, you know, I think about this a lot with, to bring up an old wound, to pick at an old scab, you know, 2011, right? Where the Canucks force a 7-game series in which they score 8 goals total. And everyone blames the goaltender because, you know, he didn't play well in game 6 and 7. And I get it to some extent. But fundamentally, you can have the goaltending edge. You can be a lockdown defensive team. You play 2.5 months of playoff hockey. You're going to fall behind 3-0. You're going to have a game where your goalie isn't at their best. You're going to have a game where things go against you. And I always think about the narrative difference, obviously, between Tim Thomas and Roberto Luongo, and think about that Tampa Bay series that the Boston Bruins won in Game 7 by a single goal, and how, you know, Thomas played 3 good games in that series. 3 good games in that series, which isn't too different from what Luongo did in the Stanley Cup Final in 2011. It's just in the other one, after falling behind significantly, Tyler Seguin went nuke. Rookie Tyler Seguin went nuke at I think a 4-point period, 5 points in the game, and they won a 6-5 game. Like, at some point in the playoffs, the wheels are going to come off and things are going to go badly for you, and you're going to need that goal. You're going to need that push to score. You know, one of my concerns about this team has been, do they have that gear 5-on-5? If the margins narrow and the opponent scores first and then they get the second one, you know, and we're in game 5 and you're going to get one power play opportunity in the latter 40 minutes of the game, can you come back, right? And what I like about this week, too, is this top six, with the way it's formed, at least makes me say, hey, maybe. Maybe for the first time all year.
I do think the other element there in terms of being able to come back, not necessarily playing with the lead in the playoffs. Now, it is the playoffs, and as you said, if it's game 6 or 7, you certainly can't count on the opportunities, but these games can happen early in the series. I think the power play is a huge part of this, right? Getting the power play going where, hey, let's say you're playing the Kings round 2 and they score first. We know what the Kings can do to teams 5-on-5, and the Canucks might be in that situation. If the power play can be a legitimate way, a dangerous way for you to get back in the game, right? And kind of, okay, at least get back to even footing, reset the game at 5-on-5, and go from there. I think that's you can't just have one really strong thing or one or two really good things about your team if you're going to go deep in the playoffs.
Yeah.
Right? You need to have a bunch of different ways where you can win games and turn things in your favor. And I still think with the talent they have, the power play has to be one of those. As much as power plays later in the playoff series diminish and all that, it's still important. It's still something they need to be an edge for them.
It needs to work for you. Especially when you're a team built like the Canucks are, where they have the personnel that they should be really good.
It just feels like leaving money on the table if it's not really good for this team. You know what I mean?
For sure, especially with this shot, this opportunity that sort of looms ahead of them. But, you know, a power play can't... It can, but it's very rare that we see a power play carry a team in the playoffs.
It's got to
right?
be a secondary edge, though.
Yeah.
A secondary thing you can rely on, right? For when, again, because as you said, other things are going to go against you. Things that should be strengths of your team. Hey, you're a really good defensive team, but a couple of wacky deflection goals going against you or whatever the case is. And I just think you need to have... Yeah, exactly. You need to have that next layer of things you can rely on, or at least
outs.
Things
outs.
You can use to, again, tilt things back in your favor. What have you thought about the power play over this kind of last week that we've been away? I mean, I know that Miller's been in his traditional spot on the flank, on the left flank, a lot more often. I know he scores that nice slapshot goal against Calgary on Saturday in a big moment. To me, it's looked sharper, and I think maybe I'm just straining for signs of life because I do think it's so important. But I think step one was just like get guys back in their proper spots, get JT Miller back where he's so dangerous. And at least they've done that. And I hope that it's putting them in a position to, you know, get on that run that they need to do going into the playoffs.
I think it's looked okay. You know, I mean, I think it's looked okay. I don't think it's back to what we saw by any means in October and November. I still think there's work to do, but I think it's looked okay. And that's a huge improvement over what it's looked like for most of, you know, okay is fine for the most. It's not great. It's not that secondary edge you're hoping for, but it's fine.
At least like pointing in the right direction, signs of life, right?
Yeah.
Which they needed in a bad way.
100%
from that unit.
I'm probably more buying the penalty killing improvement, right? Like the last week, the penalty kills looked absolutely suffocating. You know, we'll see, like the Canucks are going to play some teams that are pretty good on the power play here in the next little bit. So we'll see if it can continue, but I think the Canucks penalty kill has looked smothering in a way it hasn't in years, 5 years, maybe longer, decade. I don't know. I can't think of the last good Canucks penalty kill. It's been a long time. And I'm not saying this is it, by the way, right? Like all year they've profiled as, you know, within a stone's throw of average, maybe a bit below. Right. And that's fine. That's what they needed to do this year to get to this place. But to go further, you know, I don't think you can be leaky on the penalty kill come playoff time. So
no.
Anyway, I think there's been a real sign of progress in that area of their game over the course of the past week. The power play too, but I think to a lesser extent. I'm not looking on the like buying, selling special teams, like the power play is fixed. I'm probably selling that, eyeing that skeptically. The penalty kill is getting hot. That I'm a little bit more interested in based on underlying form and how good a job they're doing pressuring like puck handlers up high and being really tough to enter the zone against. Like those two areas, I think, have been at their best over the course of the past week and a half, 10 days. And I think that's real. The power play being fixed, I need to see more.
Yeah, it's funny because I can't believe I'm saying this, but like if I could choose one of the special teams units to really level up between now and the playoffs, I would choose the power play. Just because I think it just feels ridiculous for this team not to have a really good power play with all the talent that they have. And we've seen them, like as you said, like, hey, average penalty kill, that would be incredible. You know, you sell that to people at the beginning of the year. It's like, yeah, let's go. Average penalty kill. I can live with that. But there's just something inherently frustrating about watching a power play with JT Miller, Quinn Hughes and Elias Pettersson not click at a high level. You know what I mean? It's like, what's going on here? These guys are incredible.
It's like trying to get ketchup out of a glass bottle.
Yeah.
you're just like, what the
why?
Hell?
Shouldn't it be designed to come out? What's going on? Andrew in Victoria says, is it greedy of me to want another 8-goal victory in that game 80 against the Oilers this year? Yeah, I would say that's greedy. Yeah, and big resounding win. That'd be nice. It'd be hilarious.
It'd be hilarious.
To capstone your year, bookend your year with massive blowout wins of the Oilers.
It does feel...
Well, and hey, the last time they did it completely, the Oilers were spinning their wheels, to say the least. They were hopeless for a little bit there.
The best laid plans never seem to come to fruition in hockey, but it does feel in some ways like these teams are destined for a playoff collision. Right? Just especially mm-hmm. with the way that start to the season set both teams on wildly disparate yep. trajectories over the course of the year.
It's so funny because we make such a big deal about the first game of a season, right? Like everyone's so excited. There's so much hype.
Well, especially when it's back to back. I had that take. I thought the Oilers were going to come in. Mm-hmm. I thought there was a chance that the Oilers would view this, given how competitive the guys in that room are, as a chance to kill a threat in the cradle effectively.
Yeah.
And instead the Canucks hit the Oilers so heavily in the solar plexus, it feels like it took them a month to stop staggering.
And my point is, like, usually it's like, oh man, game one, we're so excited. What are we going to learn? What are we going to see? And especially, with this Canucks team, the start, that was so important, but ultimately it's just one game out of 82. Usually this year, it feels like it actually had so much significance for both teams. Like, it drove so much of what happened for these teams. And the Canucks, they get off to that incredible start, and it kind of bought them the time to really round into a really impressive team, as they've done now in the new year, or in the last 6 weeks anyways. And for the Oilers, I mean, man, it just had them completely off kilter, and they needed a 16-game winning streak to kind of get back to, number two in the division where they are now.
Well, a very funny thing was, I still remember Dom Lecision shot me a text immediately after the game. And had plugged in the 8-1 outcome into his model, right? And he said the caption was the difference one game makes, and his model elevated the Canucks from plus one offensive rating, which was 17th in the league, mm-hmm. to plus nine, which was 14th off of one game, and plus six in net rating, which is 18th in the league, right? True bubble team, to plus 14, which was 14th in the league, right? So it's like, that game was such a statement, such a convincing statement, that even like an objective model designed not to overreact to weird
game.
Outcomes couldn't help but be like, hey, that's impressive.
And then
even Hal was like, yes, I will open the bay door, Scott.
You've convinced me. I got swept up in the emotion of the moment. Incredible. And then they haven't played each other. Like, the Canucks...
Well, they played each other one more.
But even then, the Oilers were still in their swoon. Like, that was still the Jay Woodcroft Oilers, right? And it wasn't the same type of, like, true blowout, but the Canucks still kind of clowned them a little bit in that third meeting at Rogers Arena. It wasn't the last game before Woodcroft got let go, but it was close. I think it was just a couple of games after that. And then they haven't played. And then, like, the Canucks have leveled up and rounded into form as a true contender. The Oilers went on that incredible hot streak. These teams were so intertwined early in the season. And then we've had this big, big, big long layoff of them meeting each other. It's going to be fascinating to see what that game 80 looks like. And if they do get a playoff series, I mean, my goodness, that's going to be absolutely incredible. Go ahead.
One thing I was thinking about while on vacation a little bit, looking ahead to the playoffs and thinking with a wide angle lens about what comes next and making playoff predictions and on and on. So I'm just, this is a pure digression for 5 minutes. Okay. How do you pick when you do it? Inside baseball, how the sausage gets made stuff. When you pick playoff teams or playoff series and you have to pick a team and the number of games, what's your method?
So honestly, a lot of it is just like gut. It's almost like if someone was like showing me
you shoot from the hip.
Yeah,
you're a gut guy.
It's almost like if somebody was showing me like what are the like a Rorschach test or something. Right? It's just like what's the first thing that pops into your mind. You know what I mean?
Okay, and so not exactly
like,
scientific.
No. But then like that's my first method. I'm like, oh wow, no, I really think it's gonna be Dallas or whoever. And I kind of use that to anchor where I'm going, and then I'll dig into a little of the matchups and all that and, like, the underlying numbers. And then if there's a – usually, though, the underlying numbers thing, like, I'm following it closely enough during the regular season that it's built into my gut reaction. Mm. You know what I know? You know what I mean? Like, if I know one team kind of secretly sucks even though they made the playoffs,
right,
that's built into my gut reaction. But that's kind of, like, I anchor myself first with just, like, okay, instantly, flashcards. What do I think about this? And then I kind of do a little bit of a deeper dive. But I also, like, I'm going to be perfectly honest here. It's not like I'm, like, choked if I don't get a lot right. It's like, whatever. It's picking the hockey playoffs. It's super hard.
Oh, super hard.
I'm not like, oh, no, I only got three of the series right. Like, I don't care.
Dude, if you throw $10 on a parlay of every series winner and number of games correctly, the payout will be, like, $500,000, right?
Yes.
Like, it's hard to do for a reason.
Yeah.
So I find it fascinating because there's four outcomes per team, right? So, like, you win in four, you win in five, you win in six, you win in seven. And I've kind of created this method in my head where it's like, I assume that the teams mostly get eliminated because of math. Teams mostly get eliminated on the road, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of use that. If I like the...
So the road team will win in six or the home team will win in five or seven.
Right. Yeah. So the I basically have two binaries. That exist here. Two binary decisions represented by the four possible outcomes, right? Which is, or I guess three, because which team's going to win, in my mind? And then, will it be close, right? Because that's a four or five.
Mm-hmm.
Will it be close, then it's a six or seven.
Yeah.
Will it not be close? But when I'm picking it to not be close, like, let me give you an example. You can have a close series that ends in five games. Like, I've seen so many series
100%.
Where it's like the first three games are incredibly, you can have a close sweep. That Carolina sweep loss to the Florida Panthers in the conference final, all those games were one goal games, two OT games. You know what I mean? It was just like blink and it's over. All of the weighted coin flips went one way, but it was 50-50 in terms of the flow of play. You can also have a blowout that goes seven games and gets decided late. Think about the Canucks Vegas series in the bubble. Like, that's as lopsided a playoff series as I've seen, and went the distance. Vegas didn't score the game winning goal until 7 minutes until it was 7 minutes remaining in the third period.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in some ways I'm almost doing it wrong because I'm not like, I'm trying to indicate how I see the teams in terms of a true talent basis, but a true talent basis ultimately isn't what's going to decide a playoff series. And that's kind of where I've been thinking about, like, how the Canucks measure up, you know, against the Kings, right? Like, what I can tell you about the Kings is if the Canucks face the Kings in the playoffs, I'm picking it to go six or seven.
Sure. And I think
that's
very reasonable.
No matter what, yeah. I think these teams are wildly closely matched, right?
Well, I made this point when we had Gemma on, but, like, with what Nashville has done and the fact that Vegas is the defending Stanley Cup champs, there's not going to be a lot of daylight between, like, for top to bottom of the eight playoff teams in the Western Conference. Like, I think people are going to be picking a lot of games to go six or seven.
With the exception that, in my mind, I still do think that the Oilers and the Avs have the highest ceiling outcomes of any of those eight teams.
Sure.
I'll hear arguments for Dallas.
But let's say it's Colorado-Vegas in the first round. Are you going to be like, oh, Colorado in five?
I think so.
I get that, but I don't. But it's to me, that's still way different than your typical, like, 1-8 series.
You're right. The gear though that team has hit since the deadline. I mean, that work at the deadline feels like it could be something we're looking back on in the years to come. It's just been so perfect stylistically. That team is so scary right now in my mind. Anyway,
it was pretty incredible.
I just wanted to chat about it because it's been something that I've been really thinking about as I prepare to cover the playoffs, and something I wanted to share because I think it's an interesting way of reminding people of the difference, right, between form and outcome, especially in a hyper variable game like.
Well, and just the fact that you can lose in four or five games, and it doesn't mean you were a disaster in that playoff round, right? The games could have all been really, really close. That's just how it goes sometimes in the NHL. All right, it's good to be back. The Canucks could clinch a playoff spot tonight. Either way, we will be back on the air tomorrow to break it all down. It's a Canucks game day. Keep it right here on Sportsnet 650.